The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, can somebody tell me what the homeobox genes are? They're often called Hox genes. What do they code for? Transcription factors, exactly. And if you delete certain Hox genes or change their position even, you can get abnormalities in the segmentation of the body. Some of that has been done with flies. They can produce a fly, for example, with legs coming out of his head or something like that. You know. And it's interesting of the arrangement on the chromosome that the position of the gene in the sequence of genes on the chromosome is always consistent right across different species. As we saw last time, this slide of a mouse showing the expression of three different genes, but they were doing immunostaining of the antibodies for the proteins of those genes. And here, this is actually not, it's mesodermal expression, but these genes are expressed in the nervous system and in other body tissues. But you see how each one of them, each of these transcription factors, has a roster limit for its expression. Less precise on the caudal side. But now if you look at the hindbrain, during development of a certain period, you see this pattern appearing, a segmentation that's visible in the bulges of the hindbrain. We call them rhombal mirrors. Mirror for the section or segment. Rhombo, of course, for the rhombencephalon. And these are the segmentation of the rhombencephalon. And when you look at the expression of transcription factors, including many of the Hox genes, they have an interesting pattern. And here's a little cartoon of the rhombal mirrors of the hindbrain, from rostral here on the left to caudal on the right. And if you look at the pattern of gene expression this way, it sort of looks like a barcode. It's interesting that some of them are expressed in like one rhombal mirror, and then they're not expressed in the next one, then they are expressed in the next one down the line. And that's true of a number of them. You see here they skip two. So this one's in one and two, not in three. Then these two are both present in the fourth. And they're present again in the sixth, and one of them is also in the seventh. So that's true of a number of different genes. And this is just one experiment showing an effect of these genes. Here you're seeing what you saw in the previous slide, expression of these particular Hox genes. There's two that have that more limited expression in just certain segments and not others. If you take stem cells, basically the precursor cells from the embryo, and inject them in another embryo, if you do it before those rhombal mirrors form, you can inject them near a boundary and they spread right across that boundary, because the boundary is before those genes are expressed. it doesn't have the reality it does later, because after the rhombomeres appear, you inject those cells and they don't move over a boundary. Of course, the genes must be doing many other things too. We know that there's developmental differences. The motor neurons that originate in a particular rhombomere just innervate a particular part of the mesoderm corresponding to the branchial arches of the embryo. All right. So now this entire class is about the hindbrain and the cranial nerves of the hindbrain. We've talked a bit about hindbrain specializations already in Chapter 6, but we'll talk a little more about hindbrain specializations today. So first, back to the columns of the secondary sensory neurons and the motor neurons, and compare the hindbrain and spinal cord. This is probably the third time I've presented it. I want you to start to remember it. In this case, I'm showing here for the spinal cord. This is based on a figure of Nauta where I've added the colors, the sensory and motor columns, but also I've colored in the visceral column, the preganglionic motor neurons of the sympathetic system. And then in the hindbrain, I've used the red color for the visceral sensory and visceral motor neurons. Visceral sensory gets input from the entire gut. Yeah, they do have sensory fibers that they come in through dorsal roots, but they reach this nucleus in the hindbrain. The rostral part of the nucleus is the case nucleus, getting input from the 7th, 9th, and 10th cranial nerves. But here, just across the boundary between ailer and basal plates, you have the visceral motor column. That's this very long column, the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus nerve. And you'll note here there's just two roots, the dorsal root and ventral root at each segment. That's not true in the hindbrain. Okay, here the sensory fibers are coming in two different positions. This is where the input, say, from the auditory and vestibular senses would come in, whereas the somatosensory input from the face comes in a little further ventrally, the trigeminal nerve. And then you have, so these are sensory nerves, but the fifth actually has a motor component too. It has a motor nucleus. It's just on the other side of this boundary, but it's the masticatory nucleus for chewing movements, and it goes out, it joins the sensory fibers of the fifth nerve. I don't show that here. And then you have mixed nerves, the 7th, 9th, and 10th primarily, where you have a mixture of sensory fibers and motor fibers, so no law of roots at all. But then you have a somatic motor column, controlling eye movements and controlling tongue movements that just contain the motor neuron accents. Okay, so I want to now go through cranial nerves a little bit, and then we'll talk about the hindbrain some more, naming cell groups, looking at fibers going through the cord and fibers from those cranial nerves. But first of all, what is a sensory placode? Remember how the secondary sensory neurons of the spinal cord originate from neural crest cells. Okay? The secondary sensory neurons of the cranial nerves don't just originate in neural crest in the head region. They also originate from sensory placodes. What is a placode? There's several of them. They contribute to the 8th nerves, audition and vestibular sense, the olfactory neurons originate in a placode. Okay. It's just a piece of the ectodermal tissue, the surface tissue, that is neurogenic. Okay, it gives rise to, among other things, to neurons. Okay. So they don't, all those secondary sensory cells don't come from the middle crest. Okay. And then we want to know about the cranial nerves and their number. I have a table in the book. You start studying that table because I'm going to give you some time, but we're going to memorize all the cranial nerves and a few things about them. I'll give you more instruction about that, but I want you to start paying attention to that, because when I say seventh nerve, I expect you to know what it is. If I say the 12th nerve, you should know what it is. Now you probably don't, but just start learning it, and over time, pretty much the numbers and the names mean the same thing to you after a while. You need to know the number and the name and a little bit about the function, at least sensory or motor. Okay. So these placodes, say a little more about them. There's a first of all, the dorsolateral placodes include the trigeminal placode, okay? There's two main portions, ophthalmic and the maxillary and mandibular portions. They give rise to the secondary sensory cells of the trigeminal ganglia, okay? That make up the trigeminal, the axons of those cells, those neurons give rise, of course, to the trigeminal nerve, the fifth cranial nerve. And then the otic placode, another one of the dorsolateral placodes, then they're named according to position in the embryo. That gives rise to vestibular and auditory secondary sensory cells, those ganglion cells that are outside the central nervous system. And then, as I already mentioned, the olfactory placode gives rise to the olfactory epithelium. Remember, the primary sensory neurons are right in the epithelium. That is a specialized region, thickened region of the ectoderm that gives rise to that. There's also, I don't stress this, but there's an epibranchial, sometimes called epipharyngeal placode that gives rise to some of the ganglion cells of nerves 7, 9, and 10, but those are more complicated because the neural crest also contributes to them. All right, so let's talk about these cranial nerves. The 12 cranial nerves is actually not a full description at all. Even humans have more than that, especially in the embryo. So why is it so traditional to name just 12? It's because it is pretty adequate to describe the adult brain. There's a table in the Butler and Hodos book that lists 25 different cranial nerves. Okay? Some of them are found only in certain groups of vertebrates. We've mentioned a few times here the lateral line nerves. There's up to 6 of them in animals, say, with electrical reception. There's also mechanical lateral line organs, mechanosensory organs. But most vertebrates don't have those, but some of our cranial nerves in mammals, like the facial or the glossopharyngeal or the vagus nerve, there's actually 2 distinct parts, but the nerve forms of fibers. The fibers of those 2 components are together in many vertebrates and in humans. Okay. So the tradition is to name just 12 for human. We ignore very tiny nerves that we don't know much about the function. And it certainly accounts for all the things that are well known and well studied in the vertebrates. So we just learned 12. So let's take now a look at the caudal hindbrain of an adult mammal, and look at the location of the cell groups, look at those columns of secondary sensory neurons and motor neurons, and also where the axons are that are passing through. We're going to look at figure 10.10 in the book. It's a slice through the adult caudal hindbrain. That is the part of the hindbrain we call the medulla, or medulla oblongata. The elongation of the spinal cord, not below the cerebellar region, and the pontine region. First of all, what are the sensory modalities that you know about from that caudal hindbrain region? We mentioned them a number of times already. I've even mentioned them in this lecture. Auditory, vestibular. What about somatosensory? Of course. That's a hindbrain nerve too, the trigeminal. That starts in the rostral hindbrain, but you still see it in the caudal hindbrain because of the very long descending nucleus of that system. And in addition, you have visceral sensory, and we include in that the taste sense. Okay, all of that's represented. I know you can answer this one. Which cranial nerves carry somatosensory input from the face into the brain? You should by now know the number and the name of that nerve. What is it? Trigeminal nerve, the fifth. Fifth nerve. So we want to look, first of all, where are the primary sensory neurons? Like every dorsal root, every cranial nerve, the Canadian sensory fibers? The answer to this question is always the same. Where are the cell bodies? In a, what's the word? Not nucleus. If you're outside the CNS, what's it called? A ganglion, right. So it's in the trigeminal ganglion. Okay? It's a big ganglion. It sits on either side of the hypothalamus. But it has nothing to do with the hypothalamus. Okay? It just happens to be there at the base of the brain. That's because the nerves are coming in from the head region, from the face. Okay? And they're coming in under the brain. And they enter the rostral part of the hindbrain. They actually penetrate through the rostral pontine region. Okay, below the cerebellum. So where are the secondary sensory neurons? Well, they're in the hindbrain, and they've got to be in this region here, okay, in that column. So let's look now at the adult hindbrain here. This is where those trigeminal nerve cells are. You'll see them in that position in every section of the hindbrain. From the rostral portion, where the cerebellum distorts the whole picture so much. We'll take a look at that by the end of the class. And it just continues because axons form right, that follow this area right here. A lot of axons coming from our rostral. You only see them penetrating very far rostral. So this would have to be a section of the embryonic brain to actually be coming in at this point. Okay. So what else did we ask there? We've already answered. Here's where you see the special senses coming in, vestibular, auditory, and that's exactly the position at the very caudal end. When you're entering the spinal cord, that's where the dorsal column nuclei are. But the dorsal column nuclei are really in the very rostral end of the spinal cord. Some people though still call that hindbrain. Here's where the motor axons come out from the So all the eye muscles are controlled by neurons like this. There's only one that doesn't exit that way, the fourth nerve, the trochlear nucleus. But otherwise it's the same as all the others. And then the nuclei controlling the tongue, the hypoglossal nucleus. So that's very much like a ventral group. But look at the axons now going through. I show them all here. The descending pathways. Here is the sort of pyramidal shape of the pyramidal tract coming from the cortex. Corticospinal axons, pyramidal tract, right at the base. They always run on either side. When you look even at a sheep brain, you turn it over and you look the ventral side, you'll see these grooves. A little groove on the midline. The basilar artery might be there if it hasn't been pulled away. But then you'll see a little bit of an indentation at the edge of the pyramidal tract, and this will have a slightly whitish appearance because of the myelin. Alright. And then right above it, you see the sensory fibers coming from the spinal cord and from the dorsal column nuclei. Dorsal column nuclei give rise to the medial meniscus. So if this is the medial meniscus here on the right side, where are the cells that gave rise to those medial meniscus axons? You remember? Dorsal column, medial meniscus. Those two names should be starting to link in your mind. Dorsal column, medial meniscus pathway. So where would the cells be? They would be at the top of the spinal cord in the dorsal column nuclei, but on the other side. There's a decussation at the caudal end of the hindbrain. You drew that out in your homework. Alright. And then we have, I drew the descending pathways on the left here, and I'm showing you where the, for example, the tectospinal axons are. Axons from the vestibular nucleus also follow that, and axons from the cerebellum. Now, if you imagine that the brainstem is transparent, and you want to see where each of these groups of nuclei are, study this, and this, I use color coding to see them. So I've shown the sensory cell groups here. This figure is based on Nauta. And the motor groups on the left. So that's where you see the cochlear nuclei. And a little below the cochlear nucleus and a little more medial, you see the vestibular nuclei. Fairly large nuclei. There's actually four separate nuclei. We just lump them together, call them the vestibular nuclei. Cochlear nuclei, there's two or three, depending on how you divide it up. We just call them the cochlear nuclei here. And then trigemma. And see, there's the principal nucleus, but here's the axons that come in. Way up here, they keep going, go all the way down into the top of the spinal cord. They go a little further than this picture shows. That's all secondary sensory cells representing inputs coming at the face. Okay, and what is the remaining one? Well, it's a red color, so it's got to be visceral or taste. It has a particular name because of its appearance in a nissl stain. It's called the nucleus of the solitary tract. Okay. Because a tract that does stand out, even in the nissl stain, can be seen right next to it. Solitary tract. Many taste fibers in that tract, as well as visceral sensory fibers coming in from cranial nerves. Cranial nerve 10 primarily, but also from 7 and 9. And then the various motor neuron groups are shown here. And it includes some that weren't in the other picture. because they're very small nuclei. They're part of that visceral motor cell group column that controls salivation. Okay, now, those kinds of figures, this one and this one, don't memorize them. Use them for reference. If you forget, and you're reading something about these nuclei, you want to remember where they were. Look back at chapter 10 and look up where they are. And notice they go all the way up into the midbrain. Okay? I mentioned that the one in red there, the Eddinger-Westphal nucleus, remember what it controls? The pupils, pupillary size. Not the blink of the eye, but just the pupils of the eye, the iris. Okay? And then the oculomotor nuclei, the third and fourth, and then one more down here, the sixth, controlling different directions of eye movement. Alright. So we want to look more at these trigeminal nuclei, but I want to say a little, go back to this topic about the evolution of the system, because these pathways and where they terminated were pretty important factors in influencing the evolution of the hindbrain and also more rostral structures. So first of all, where does the information go when it comes in the trigeminal nerve? There should be local reflexes. I just mentioned eye blink. Well, that's a reflex that depends on input coming in to the trigeminal nerve. It could come in. It could come from the cornea. A puff of air will cause an eye blink. It could be a touch of the eyelashes or a touch of the face. Okay. It also could just be visual input. Okay, but we're concerned here with the somatosensory input. There's got to be a pathway for the eye blink. So look at that. I mentioned that it could be considered a fixed action pattern. There's actually a drive associated with it to blink your eyes periodically. It's very important in keeping the cornea lubricated. And then we have the lemniscal pathways. Remember the lemniscal pathways in the spinal cord. There's a spinal reticular pathway. There were the spinal thalamic tract and then the dorsal column medial lemniscus system. There must be equivalent systems here for the trigeminal system. But first, let's go through this hypothesis that the decussation of axons to the midbrain and forebrain evolved with or after the evolution of the crossed retinal projection to the between brain and midbrain. And that led to cross projections of the trigeminal system as well, and even the auditory system has been affected by that. So, in fact, the entire midbrain and forebrain, the sensory world, is represented upside opposite to where the brain representation is, but not in the hindbrain and spinal cord. So what is the most ancient ascending pathway from the secondary sensory neurons of the trigeminal system? What did I just call it? What was the oldest one from the spinal cord? When you say it louder than that, spinal reticular. So what do we call it here in the hindbrain now? Trigeminal reticular. Okay? And then you should be able to at least give a quick description of the hypothesis for how somatosensory and visual system pathways evolved to become predominantly crossed. In the simplest possible way, the hypothesis is that it was to increase the speed of escape movements. So let's go through that in a little more detail. First of all, in these little diagrams, I've sketched spinal reticular and trigeminal reticular pathways. mostly ipsilateral pathways, but a few axons, spinal and even in brain levels, I reach the other side. And then here I show the same, I leave the spinal reticular and I add to it here in black the trigeminal reticular. Axons that ascend as far as the vericaudal forebrain. I don't show that here because there's so few of them, but I show them mainly in the midbrain and hindbrain. Going into the reticular formation and a few of the axons going to the other side. Okay. That's all you have in the most primitive vertebrates. Okay? That's the somatosensory pathway. But in all the more advanced creatures, you end up with these cross pathways. And I just have a few drawings to illustrate that. Start with this one. These were the basis for those figures you have in the book. So what I'm showing here is, first of all, here's the trigeminal input. And here I show spinal reticular pathways. And note a few of them are getting to the other side. Most of them are ipsilateral. Here's the retinal, primitive retinal input, the most ancient pathway, coming in to the hypothalamus. And even in modern mammals, that pathway goes pretty much equally to the same, to the two sides. In the hamster, where I've studied it with several different methods, I can't discriminate the quantity in the two sides. It's a bilateral projection. It's a little nucleus, and there, that sits above the optic chiasm, and the fibers go mainly to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, but they also spill outside it and go to the adjacent areas. All right. So the question is, why, with further evolution, do they end up mainly crossed? Here's what the animal had to do. If it's going to get away from something coming here from the right side, it causes a shadow affecting the lateral eye, it could be touching the animal or causing water currents. Okay, so you get trigeminal and visual input. What we want to do is turn away and swim like hell. Right? The turning away was critical, and people have generally ignored this in studying it. They studied the, what they call a startle response or rapid swimming, but they forget that they don't want to swim right towards the attacking animal. They want to turn. So I think the speed of that was very important. That's my hypothesis. So the result was, to get turning, you need to contract muscles on the left for input coming in to the right. So you've got to reach motor neurons on the left. Okay? And if you're doing that with forebrain input, in the case of the visual system, there were no long pathways going all the way down to the spinal cord or even the hindbrain. Okay, there were neurons though in the midbrain that went directly to hindbrain and spinal cord. So that's what I'm showing in red. So the most rapid pathway to get there was a cross pathway. You save, even saving a very small fraction of a second could make the difference between living and dying. Yes? There are, again, for the hindbrain and spinal cord, they don't cross. Okay? And what's critical here is what's in the hindbrain and spinal cord. So the midbrain pathway that reaches those is uncrossed. Alright? And that's very clear even in modern mammals. So, this is the behavior, these are the pathways that had to evolve to get that very rapid response. The question is then, how did that evolve afterwards? And I'll just go through that quickly here. We know this just says what I just have already gone through. We know that the projection to the midbrain surface became topographically organized. And with topographic input, first of all, it could add a little bit of directionality to that escape response. I'm not sure just how important that would have been. But one thing's very clear, that once you have a topographic projection, it becomes useful for a lot of things besides just rapid escape. When you look at escape responses in animals, the direction they turn in doesn't differ that much. Depending, it generally is away from the animal, but it doesn't vary that much. But if you want to find food, turn towards something that's not dangerous, or towards a mate, or towards another fish, then of course the topography, it becomes critical. And for that, again, the most efficient was, you've got to contract the muscles on the opposite side. Instead of doing this, if you want to orient towards something, if it's not dangerous, you know, you're going to have to contract the muscles on the other side. So that led to the evolution. This is from our earlier class, where I show input to the surface of the midbrain. Here is the ipsilateral descending pathway controlling local motion. Here, then, is the cross pathway controlling turning towards. And that's the pectospinal path. It only reaches the rostralmost part of the spinal cord in the animals that I know about, and it's been studied in a number of different animals. So you end up with a cross pathway from the tectum and an uncross pathway with very different functions. Right? And once this visual pathway became crossed, the somatosensory pathways and even the auditory that also gave information about the space around the head had to match it. Otherwise, there's a mismatch between somatosensory and visual and between auditory and visual. And that's exactly what happened in evolution. Okay? And that is how all the senses, midbrain and forebrain, became represented on the opposite side of space. Yes, it is. So that simply is arguing for the importance of visual system very early. There is some variation when you look across species, that some species have projections that are more bilateral in their forebrain. But they're more specialized species. You know, I'm talking about sort of the main line that led to modern mammals. But there is some variation, and I don't know of any review that's gone through. I know individual studies that show some of these odd pathways. But most of the vertebrates have the kind of pathways I'm talking about. And the very ancient ones, this is what you have. Well, the most ancient ones don't even have the spinal thalamic tract crossed yet. They just have spinal reticular. There's a lot more study that could be done, especially on those primitive animals, to look for more evidence of this. And animals like Amphioxus, you don't see any, we don't know much. They're just little pigmented areas. They would respond to shadows. But there were animals after Amphioxus and before the hagfish and the sea lampreys, though, that we only have fossil records. We know, though, that lateral eyes did appear. You know, long, long before the hagfish and lampreys. Yes. I have to talk louder. This is such a noise that I can't. Good question. Not sure. Let's see what else. I want to say a little more about the trigeminal system. In this picture, I'm showing where they are in the embryo. And then here they are in the hindbrain again. Okay? And here I've just shown the trigeminal, left the others out, but I've included the facial motor nucleus because I want to show the simplest pathway for the eye blink, going directly from interneurons here in the trigeminal nucleus, going to either by way of interneurons or like to this neuron, or directly to the facial motor nucleus causing the eye blink. I assume that some of the pathways are probably direct because it's very important functionally for that to be a rapid movement. It's a little bit like the escape response. It's protective, it's preserving the eyes. So it's very rapid. Okay, now I want you to be able to contrast the trigeminal nerve and the trigeminal meniscus. Think of the meaning of each of those terms. Trigeminal nerve, primary sensory cell axons. Okay? These are the axons of cells in the trigeminal ganglion. Then what is the trigeminal meniscus? Well, what is the secondary sensory axons exactly? Just like from the spinal cord. But now we're talking about pathways that originate in the hindbrain. This looks complicated only because I added some other nuclei here and a bunch of words, but I can very simply show you what I'm talking about. Here's the trigeminal ganglion sitting, remember, below the brain in humans. Here's its three branches, ophthalmic, maxillary, and mandibular branches of the trigeminal nerve. There the cell bodies are in that ganglion. And here the axon comes in and terminates in the trigeminal nuclei. Sometimes that's called the brainstem trigeminal complex. They're just secondary sensory cells of the trigeminal nuclei. Principal nucleus at the top and then the descending nucleus. They're all getting direct input from those primary sensory axons. Okay, now the cells there, if they're not forming a reflex, like that eye blink reflex, they may be sending an axon across the midline and ascending in a meniscus. That's the trigeminal meniscus. We can't separate spinal, like in the spinal cord, we have the spinal thalamic and the dorsal column, medial meniscus. There are axons of different size. Obviously, the ones from up here are going to reach the somatosensory cortex a lot more rapidly. They're more like the dorsal column system and the medial meniscus. Whereas the ones down here, including pain input that goes down into the spinal cord, those pathways to the brain are slower, more like the spinal thalamic tract. But they're all called trigeminal meniscus. You can see them. They simply join the medial meniscus and spinal thalamic tract axons as they course there through the midbrain into the caudothalamus, terminate in the ventral posterior nucleus, where the cells then project to the somatosensory cortex. So very much like the spinal cord, I'm leaving out the spinal reticular here, just showing these more recently evolved pathways that are so important in getting to the forebrain. And I already mentioned this is where the pain input goes. Okay, and this enlarges a little bit. Here you see the crossing. These are the trigeminal and meniscus axons. Notice here in the ventral basal or ventral posterior nucleus, those two names mean the same thing. I'm showing the green here. I omit the lateralmost part. Why? Because the ventral posterior nucleus gets input from the body surface too, from the spinal cord. This is what goes out here. The body is topographically represented in that nucleus. The caudal parts of the body are here, the more medial parts here. The very medial most is input from the tongue, and there's a taste area there. Okay? the most medial part of that nucleus. And I describe there what you're seeing at each level. We talked about the role I've just mentioned here, the masticatory nucleus and feeding. And we talked about these specializations before, except this one I didn't have the picture. Amy mentioned this star-nosed mole, and notice here's that specialized organ, but here is proportionately how it's represented in the neocortex. All this is a molunculus, you know. They distort the picture according to how much brain is taken up by representing the... I didn't actually find a copy of figure from the paper, the most recent paper that mapped the star-nosed mole's cortex. That was done by John Koss at Vanderbilt. Amy found the paper, but I didn't pull the figure out yet. Okay, and then the trigeminal system representing the whiskers. So here it shows the face, and then it shows the barrel fields and cortex. But here they are in the thalamus. Well, you don't call them barrels, you call them barreloids. And down in the brainstem, you call them barrelets. Just cute names to represent the fact that you can actually see these little clumps of cells for each whisker in the hindbrain, in the thalamus, and in the cortex. We've seen this in the cortex. Wanted to show you a few more of the axons. This is from a frontal section, where each little puff of axons there, labeled with dye, which diffuses through the axons even in a fixed brain, and you can see the little puffs, one puff per whisker. And here they are cut tangentially, where you see the axons, the barrels, the cells would be mainly in the dark areas there. Here they are in acetylcholinesterase, and here they are in cytochrome C. You just keep seeing them. These various methods. And then we talked about distortions. Why don't we do the distortions? We've already seen these. But I want to talk about distortions from the incredible development of the cerebellum, which are particularly prominent in animals with a lot of manual and dexterity of other body movements. So we'll look at it for human and go through some of these terms. So we're going to end right there. We'll come right back here next time.